though I've had a long career in photography and contemporary art. I actually started my career at the Smithsonian by organizing a small Clifford Still show for the Museum of American Art. It was then called the National Collection of Fine Arts. And so I haven't gotten to stand in a room with these many glorious Clifford Stills for a while, so this is a treat for me. But I also, as I was sitting here waiting for you all to assemble, thought that this room with these monumental abstract paintings, heroic as Clifford Still intended them to be, was a perfect foil in one way, a perfect introduction for talking about the ideas that the two artists in the direction show are also talking about. Because Clifford Still was smack dab at the top of the peak known as modernism. In the 1940s and 1950s, he and his colleagues, abstract expressionist colleagues, were exuding the notion of artistic heroism, of being individuals expressing individual ideas and emotions in what was for then in the art world a fairly substantial departure from easel painting. They were doing huge paintings like this that expanded both the reach of our eye to encompass them, but also the reach of museums and galleries to hold them and show them. And those are none of the ideas that we might think of immediately when we think about the two younger artists whose works are next door, but indeed they're playing with some of those similar ideas, and the idea that the Hirshhorn, way above many other institutions, has embraced and looks at installations of media art and video is quite wonderful. So, to sort of get back to our point of this talk today, which is to introduce you to some of the ideas of the two artists in the direction show. First, I'd like to know how many people have seen the videos or the two installations. One is not a video. How many people have seen it so far? So I'll do this by way of introduction, and then I, Jenny, should we take a moment and let people go in and see them? All right, so let me just sort of introduce a few ideas that occurred to me when I first saw them, and then I'm going to let you go in, and then why don't we come back and sort of talk about it a little bit more. My claim to fame is that I've spent most of my career thinking about photography, still images. More recently, I've thought about I have thought about archives of images. And what that means is that rather than thinking about the single masterpiece image or a group of, say, 10 beautiful images by a particular artist, I've begun thinking about how photographs really function out there in the world and function out there in institutions, and they never stand alone. There's never one photograph, and there's rarely just 10 photographs. There's usually more like 1,000 photographs or 10,000 photographs in an archive of natural history or an archive of engineering or an archive of architecture, an archive of history. Photographs tend to accumulate and build up. And what I've been really interested in doing is thinking about how archives become a kind of archaeology of meaning, how photographs made for one purpose often get sifted through and aren't important until many, many years later when they are plucked out and useful for another reason. The example that I like to give is any of the geological survey photographers who worked for the American government during the 1860s and 70s and went west with geological survey teams to map out the American West in advance of the vast groups of people who got in wagon trains and went there. They made the maps, and they took teams of photographers with them. And they took hundreds and thousands of photographs that were later used to make maps and to understand the geology of places so that miners could go in. But now we value those images because they're beautiful landscapes. And so we find Timothy O'Sullivan being the subject of museum exhibitions in art museums rather than the pride of a natural history museum collection who's interested in doing work on maps. So the shift was from science to art. And often the shift can go back and forth, and that's the kind of thing that I'm interested in. How do pictures mean what they do? And I'm very interested in the provenance of meaning, how meaning changes over time, depending on the context and the reason that we look at images. And I think that that's the background that I bring to looking at these two pieces in this show, because both of them are very interested in thinking about the way pictures mean, and I'll use this term, and we can talk about it later, the spectacle of meaning and the spectacle of images and how images affect us. I think reading the label before you go in is an important thing to do. Always in museum, I have to vote for the thing that I used to do often. Writing the label at the front of an exhibit gives you many clues to how you might approach this work. And I think this one has a very important clue by having as its heading a quote from Percy Bysshe Shelley. It right at the get-go asks us to reconsider the ideas of the Romantics, the 19th century movement that was mostly thought of as a poetry movement, but certainly encompassed a number of visual artists as well. But these were artists who were very much involved with a reaction to the pre-industrial age and were really grappling with ideas of the evocativeness of life versus the rational response that we might have to things that we encounter, and we're grappling with nature versus a growing urban culture and industrial culture. And I might say that one of the things that immediately struck me about the invocation of the Romantics here is that they were exactly poised at a pre-photographic moment. They had not encountered photography yet. They had not encountered the technology of image making yet. And yet they seemed to so much prefigure a sense of what it meant to have images that moved you and could inspire both fear and loathing and also passion for of using these images to understand the world. So, how did everybody like it? Three stars? Three stars with a silver bullet? the first piece that I went in and saw was the one of Guillard's piece that has a more extensive, obvious narrative to it. And the narrative, at least as we're able to see it, has a sort of group of street fighters and a confrontation, and which one group seems to vanquish the other group, and then we're given a splendid light show, and then we're given a fabulous tour of rather dismal high-rise buildings over some presumably Eastern European kind of country. And there's just so many clues in there that call to mind so many references to 20th century history and 20th century cultural history, and certainly the wider world of contemporary art today. I went and saw it, and my husband went and saw it the next day, and we had an interesting conversation about it. So I'll sort of share the question that I had to him was, how much do you think this had to do with Guy Debord's a sort of pressy of a critic named Guy Debord's idea of the society of the spectacle? And he said he really thought that it was far more about sort of analyzing a historical moment in general and modernism in particular, and he saw it as suddenly having a conclusion that had to do with postmodernism being a critical moment that was really about evaluating modernism. That was its major contribution. Let me be clear and step back. When we see this confrontation going on in the video, immediately comes to mind, as it should, the white shirts and the red shirts. And if we don't immediately bring to mind the Russian Revolution of the white Russians and the red Russians and the fight for possession of some sort of political cultural moment, then I think that's our place to start there. That it takes place on the backdrop of these rather demoralized Soviet bloc pieces of architecture and sort of the background, the backyards of these kinds of places is, I think, a connect the dots between an earlier moment in the 20th century and a later one that may be more current. These fabulous stage scenes between these two armies, these two street gangs, seems quite wonderful to watch and kind of entertaining, and I found myself watching it a second time just so I could see how well staged this fight was between these guys. And there's all kinds of fake stuff that goes on, and somebody pretends to kick somebody. And so the artifice is there. You are meant to see it as a kind of phony stage scene, as much of our life is seen as a phony stage scene of things. We now know not to think absolutely the truth about any image we might encounter, and so too we are meant to see the raw and artificial edges of any presentation that we're given. That said, once the white army is vanquished by the red army, there seems to be some kind of celebration, and in this we're given this fabulous light show of fireworks, which the label will tell you takes place now in Paris, and fabulous music and the opera, the operatic notion of this grows into a crescendo, and at the end the building falls down. This blocky, square, modernist building collapses. And isn't that indeed what we now think of in terms of modernism having collapsed for other kinds of realities? In fact, the reality of seeing that images don't always tell the truth, that there are many meanings to be brought to bear in looking at any particular images or sequence of images or archive of images. And so the narrative may be fairly straightforward in that we're given a demonstration of an action and its result, but in fact there are layers and layers and layers of content in that piece, which brings us into a critique of political history in the 20th century, a critique of economic viability in the 20th century, a critique of modernist culture and in the form of architecture in the 20th century, and brings us up to a moment of reconsideration of how we got from here to there. I think the artist's piece, which is out here in these vitrines, is another version of that layering. It's made up of Polaroids arranged in various sequences in shapes of a diamond. And I thought this was actually a less interesting piece, except that I began to spend time with it and realized that it was in this repetitive shape, this diamond perfect shape, then each of the Polaroids has to be made at a 45 degree angle in order for them to be shaped together into these pieces. So what seems to be a fairly banal arrangement of pictures without much meaning suddenly begins to be this artificial construct of shape and form and dialogue between images that is totally shaped by the artist for meanings other than that of each of the individual Polaroids, but rather as a sort of profound construction of images that we might find anywhere that we tend to look in the world. The other piece, which is in the form of a slideshow by an artist named Torres, is a little bit simpler to deal with in terms of the technology of its presentation. It is two slide projectors showing us, in one case, a series of images, in the other case, a single image. And the subject, the ostensible subject of this piece, is a hotel called the Grape Tree Hotel. Grape Tree Bay. I actually think I went by this hotel once in its heyday. But Grape Tree Bay Hotel was built as the ultimate luxury hotel in a tourist place. It was never used very much, but it sort of fell into disrepair. But in its making, it had high aspirations to not only be a luxury hotel, but to add art into its program of luxury. And to do this, it commissioned a number of artists to do pieces. And one, Daniel Boren, was a young artist, and he did a series of mosaics for this hotel. He later changed his style completely and wanted the hotel to tear down these mosaics because he just thought they were hideous. But in fact, the hotel would not, although now it's come to pass that, in fact, the hotel has fallen down into ruin. And so the mosaics are fallen apart as well. But if you notice in the slideshow, these mosaics, in a way, play a starring role. Nature has started to engulf them. Nature has started to eat into the cracks between the mosaics and are crumbling them. But behind them, as a sort of steady screen, are these mosaics showing up over and over again. What I found very interesting about the slideshow, of course, it's in color. It's a more current view of things. But steady over here, sort of seeming to change but never really changing, is the black and white picture. This archival photograph, if you will, taken from the archive of the heyday of the hotel in black and white, functioning almost like a dream image, something that's a record photograph, a record of what was, or a memory of what was. We tend to remember the past more in black and white than we do in color, at least I do. So this never-changing picture of the past is seen in total contrast to the ever-changing picture, the evolution of what's going on now, the crumbling of what's going on now. And the fact that we're seeing these via a kind of technology, slideshows, clunking slide projectors projected on the wall, is a sort of a reminder that all technology is changing. Our sense of how to hold pictures, how to show pictures, what to do with pictures is changing. And the sort of notion of a world made instantly antiquated, instantly into a ruin, is certainly at the heart of that, which brings us back to this romantic notion of things in flux and things in danger of disappearing, that in their disappearance gives us a sense of emotion, whether it be from a Sonne Lumiere kind of presentation of a light show with the crashing down of a building, or whether it's simply a reminder that this luxurious place with that could fall into back into the jungle again. What I love about both of these things is that they function around the concept of an archive, whether the archive is based around the little case in here of sort of historical artifacts about the hotel, lending it all a sort of sense of profound history where we might have not thought so. that these photographs are all details, these Polaroids are all details of a life spent traveling the world, now arranged into some other more profound designs than we might have thought. This idea that our archive of memory is so steadily and so strong is a very important idea for not only these two artists, but I think many of the artists who work with these varying forms of technology, using images and using archives. So that's all I want to say right now, unless I can answer some questions. And anybody want to say anything about these pieces and their own thoughts about them? I would be glad to listen and talk about it. Anyone want to talk about Clifford Still? Yes. Do I know? I don't know. I think it was a piece that he selected for it. Yes. Yeah. And the other piece, I'm not sure whether that was composed for that piece or selected for that piece. I'm not sure.
I think both of them were a musical collaboration, and I think that's an interesting part.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Especially, I thought, in the Guillard piece, because it really does sort of enlarge and make more emotional the pictures that you're looking at. It's also worth noting that that piece in particular is, of course, a piece of techno music. It was sort of created via computers and machines as opposed to an orchestra or live recording. Yeah, so it seems to fit perfectly.
It does make me think about Jan mentioned this idea of failure and how if you think about it in connection to the 20th century, all these buildings, all these systems for creating environments for people have failed them. Like the riots in the streets are not that kind of thing. They're not behaving the way that the ideal system of that utopian fantasy that created those buildings. The launching fireworks off these buildings and destroying them. They're all using this utopian fantasy in a way that's kind of dystopian. And I also think that there's a failure in terms of the other piece, which is that Buren doesn't want that to be considered his work, that there's a failure of the dream for that hotel.
And
the fantasies that we have with that piece of history.
Absolutely. I absolutely said much better than I could have. But no, it's absolutely absolutely true. And I would even add to that, it sort of adds to a larger discourse that is a postmodern discourse that some of these cultural critics from the late 60s and 70s were bringing up about the failure of modernism to produce that promised utopian notion of a heroic world of the individual, and in fact did fail the individual. And that's why I think that there is an absolute reference to this idea of the Russian Revolution and even to Potemkin's cinema, the battle on the steps, the battle over the bridge, where there is this sort of conflict. And of course, we know that there was a whole group of artists in Russia at that moment who were impassioned by an idea of a utopian world in which a form of art could take a leadership position, and that failed.
Thing to consider is that there are artists now that are working with communities to look at the architecture that the community itself builds, and it's almost like a continuation of this particular work, because there we are looking at an ideal that has failed, and so the communities themselves, like in favelas in Brazil, for example, are stepping in their own communities to actually see them. there's a whole group of artists that are having, you know, working on
yes.
particular projects in all kinds of different forms. So it almost seems to me, and I don't know whether I'm right, this almost feeds into it also, like that kind of discourse about communities, architecture, who does it, who do we serve?
Well, it's like the failure of that building, you know, you launch fireworks off, and that's the entertainment for the masses, you know. So the, you know, they kind of, it's like, well, let's have a party and watch this thing kind of get destroyed. I mean, that's the way I look at it, you know. And it's more about kind of like dancing on the gravestones, you know. It's a little bit like saying, okay, this is over, and now the people are taking over, which is a very different idea of utopia. It's not a
exactly. It's not so much nostalgia I get a sense of, but I get a sort of reawakening of a notion of the sublime in this work. This idea that images can be structured, massaged in such a way as to give us a sense of shock or sadness or just pure emotion, that so that we engage again in the world, that there's been this notion of constructed reality which somehow has had drained from it a kind of emotion. We tend to deal with images and with situations in a very rational way as opposed to an emotional way. And sort of this evocation again of this romantic sublime, I think, is sort of embedded in these. There's a sort of sadness to the piece about the hotel that, you know, tried hard to be one thing and fell back into the jungle, and now we sort of look at it in as these pieces of artifacts, you know, our world, our civilization in artifacts. I mean, I think that there's a sort of, it's okay to respond emotionally to this. I think it's also true, I was looking around the corner at the first room in the Hirshhorn Permanent Collection show that has the large-scale works by Gursky and Thomas Struth and Tsujimoto and Sisung Long, I think is how you pronounce his name. But there, too, is a sort of sense of passing, of sublimity, which many people might argue is in a way one of the pieces that of photography that we always forget about in a way, because it's so embedded in the whole notion of taking a picture of a moment that will never be anymore and of saving that moment. So I think that's there, this idea of failure, but is there as well. I know. Well, I feel worse for the artists who have actually hinged their career on large scale Polaroids and are sort of desperately trying to buy as much of the paper as they can at this moment. But that it's that we won't have art like this anymore.
There are digital Polaroids out there though
now. Mm-hmm. But we can get the look. We can make them look like this. They won't actually be this.
Isn't that interesting?
Vinyl sometimes more popular than CDs.
you're saying that CDs are not as tangible as records?
Well, I mean, if we're going to just your example, vinyl and slide projector, and I think CD, I think there is less tangibility with CDs than with vinyl, just in terms of actually, you know, quoting it.
That change once there's a generation who really never knew vinyl? Really never knew it.
Well, I mean, for example, my little brother, he's 12, he grew up completely in computers and MP3s, and I left some of my vinyl at home, and so I started to...
But that came from you.
That's true.
So he did grow up with vinyl. I mean, his older brother was playing these, you know...
I think that a distinction that maybe we should make is the difference between having it be a significant piece of the everyday fabric of your life that you don't think about it, and having it be a collector's item, having it be distinguished as being something odd and special, mid-century modern furniture being the collect, you know, just decorating with it as opposed to having it be the thing that you would have found. I mean, I mean, we're living with this idea of substituting the picture of the thing for the thing itself, and this is
the Taurus slideshow reminded me a little bit of, or quite a bit, of Thomas Cole's Empire, Lost Empire, where he shows the jungle. And the savagery, and then it goes on. I'm trying to think of then they progress, and then the empire is glorious with all of this luxurious, and then there's war, and then the last one, nature has taken over, but there's always one constant. And in Cole's work, it's the mountain, and in Torrey's work, it's the water. I mean, they had the heyday, and now the jungle has taken over. Wasn't it a hurricane or something that came in and destroyed it?
I think so.
Yeah.
And it never rebuilt again.
Again, you've got nature taking over, and I sort of connected that in my own head, but possibly it's relevant.
It is, in that Thomas Cole is full-blown, authentic romanticism of an American sort, so it gets us back to... extraordinary conversation that was begun. So maybe we're facing a sort of neo-romantic notion here now. Well, thank you. I'm happy to answer any more questions.